I'm Sean Kenny, and welcome to the MFS All Angles podcast. Over the past few episodes, we've gone deep into industries, from pharma to software and energy, but today we're focused on the hyperscalers and talking about the massive CapEx expansion here in 2026. While this topic is well covered in the media, our goal today is to share some insights and focus areas coming from our research team. To do that, I'm joined by Erica Ziba and John Haddad. Erica is an equity research analyst on our technology team, and John covers technology on our investment grade fixed income team. So I want to thank you both for joining me. This is a rich conversation. There's a lot of places we can go with this, but having both equity and fixed income around the table, I think will be great for our listeners to hear how you're thinking about that within your particular coverage, but also as a team across the platform. So thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Well, so let's start with Erica. I want to start with the overall theme in the industry, which is this massive CapEx expansion. We've seen $600+ billion of commitments from just a handful of companies here in 2026. And one of the key themes that we wrote about in our 2026 outlook was, is the AI premium too high? And some of the narrative that you hear in the industry is that, is there a corollary here in 2026 with all the hype and the massive investment with AI to the dot-com bubble back in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I know we've talked about this and you share that there isn't quite the same backdrop. So maybe you could spend a little bit of time sharing your perspective on the backdrop today relative to that period in time.
Yeah, sure. I think there's so much press around the parallels, but I would actually draw, I guess, the attention to what's actually different this cycle than what was happening in the early 2000s, which are sort of a number of things. The first being that, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, the build out there was really speculative build out on the demand that was still to come, right? So we were building to demand that didn't actually materialize for 10 or 15 or 20 years in some cases, right? And so that's a huge difference. I think this time we're actually building, and the hyperscalers are building to demand in their cloud that they're actually seeing and underwriting to an RPO that they're actually printing today. So I think that's the first difference. The second difference is that, you know, the funding of the CapEx build is being underwritten by very well capitalized large enterprises with hundreds of billions of dollars actually sitting today on their balance sheets. And so when I think back to the early 2000s, that was certainly not the case, right? A lot of it was debt financed. A lot of it was speculative. A lot of it you just couldn't underwrite to a return to, whereas these companies, their bread and butter is cloud, and they're underwriting with strong balance sheets. And then I think the third thing is that, you know, the capacity that's going in the ground today is not sitting idle. So, you know, in the early 2000s, we put a lot of fiber in the ground that just sat dark, right, for a number of years. This time, we're supply constrained. So every cloud provider would tell you, look, we can't actually get enough chips fast enough to actually fulfill the demand we're seeing from our customers on the other side. And I think that continues through 26. And so I guess it would be the three big differences. I don't know if I'm missing anything, but when I think sort of back to that time period, there are a number of parallels, but I would say that this cycle certainly feels like it's off to a more healthy start from a capitalization perspective than the last.
Yeah, it's interesting. The companies that have massive balance sheets and could fund this through free cash flow are still accessing the debt markets in some cases. So John, from a fixed income perspective, we had Google make a big announcement just this week around the investment in or issuing bonds to fund this. It was unique in that it was very global, even a 100-year bond in the UK, which is pretty unique. So tell me a little bit from the fixed income perspective how you're seeing things.
Sure. Well, what's interesting is that for the first part of this journey, AI was really more of an equity market phenomenon than it was a fixed income market phenomenon. So, you know, if you think back to 2024, which was the first year we had these big CapEx step-ups, if you think about the five big investment grade hyperscalers, so Microsoft, Google, Meta, Oracle, and Amazon, collectively, they spent about $240 billion of CapEx in 2024. Net issuance, so what they issue into the market minus what they actually mature from a debt perspective in a given year, was de minimis. And so that was entirely funded with internally generated cash flows. 2025 was the pivot year. That's when we started to see them lean more heavily on their balance sheets. Those same companies spent about $400 billion in CapEx last year, and they issued about $90 billion in net issuance over the course of the year. And that actually excludes the Meta Blue Owl JV funding that we saw, which we can certainly unpack later on if you want. But that's been a little bit of a wake-up call for our market in particular, especially as you think about a starting point where credit spreads are at multi-decade tights. That's underpinned by a favorable technical backdrop. We've had inflows into the asset class, and the supply-demand picture has been very favorable. And so you have investors now beginning to reassess what that multi-year issuance from these players is going to look like. I think looking out over the next few years, you know, 2026 is going to be a year where the CapEx bumps are so large that free cash flow margins are actually thinning for a lot of these companies, and they're actually going to be leaning a lot more heavily on our market. Those same five companies are anticipated to do something north of $700 billion this year, which is a pretty big step up. Yeah. And for our market, you know, that means that $90 billion of net issuance could look something like $150 billion this year, you know, conservatively. And so that's a pretty big chunk for a market that does, you know, $1.5 trillion of issuance in a given year.
Yeah. Who are buyers of these notes? You know, these are highly rated companies. Is there value in some of these issuances?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the ownership in the corporate bond market is pretty diverse between institutions like pension funds, mutual funds like ourselves. In international flows, we've seen fairly strong international flows into the asset class. That's helped sort of support and take some of this funding down. You know, I think from our perspective on the fixed income side, and the question that I'm always asking myself is, you know, are we getting paid enough spread to really take on the risk here? You know, traditionally, companies come to the fixed income market in a certain point in their maturity life cycle, which is they tend to be further along in that, and they have stable, more stable business positions with, you know, predictable cash flows and or asset bases that can be lent against. These are, you know, somewhat uncertain, you know, investment propositions, and you know, the competitive environment could be shifting. And so as a fixed income investor, I'm constantly assessing whether, you know, I'm accidentally taking equity risk or I'm actually getting compensated for that uncertainty.
Yeah, interesting perspective. You mentioned the off-balance sheet funding, so maybe we'll spend a minute there before we get back to the equity side. But talk to me about the off-balance sheet financing. We hear a lot about these special purpose vehicles that some of these players have utilized, and even some narrative around circular funding. Any red or yellow flags from your perspective? And Eric, I'd be curious your take too.
Yeah, I think you hit on the two main ones, right? Which is when we think about off-balance sheet and worries from a debt perspective, there's kind of two avenues to it. The first one is the vendor financing, right? And circularity and this idea that we're hearkening back to the late 90s. I think there are important differences. When you look back at that period, you had equipment makers who were lending to their customers so that they could buy their own equipment, and there wasn't really any revenue on the other side. In this case, as Erica alluded to, these, you know, structures that NVIDIA is promising or whatever tend to be more equity oriented, so they're getting equity back as opposed to lending in debt form. And they're to support revenues and backlog that's here today, and so from a supply constrained position. So I think that is a key difference that should be highlighted. That being said, it is a watch item. We're watching it really closely, and you know, there could be a tipping point here to the extent that continues to escalate and could create issues.
Yeah. Okay.
The other piece of it that you also hit on is just off balance sheet. And so what we've noticed is some of these weaker players who have less capacity to fund this on their own balance sheets, the Metas and the Oracles of the world, are increasingly looking to off balance sheet vehicles to get the funding in order to build this out. So there's a couple avenues that takes. Mm-hmm. It's in some cases a JV where they're bringing in a private equity partner to actually own the data center. And then there's other instances where it's just off balance sheet leases or guarantees or whatnot that the company's making over a very long period of time. In both of those instances, as a credit investor, you know, we're thinking about that and in leverage and credit metrics, the rating agencies consider all of that as well. And so I wouldn't say that these companies are necessarily getting a free lunch. It's more around flexibility, I think, from a capacity perspective.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
I'll just add one thing on circular financing too, because I think it gets a lot of negative press, and to a large extent, it's a watch item for us. But I think there's a couple of things that make it a little bit more healthy than what we certainly experienced in the early 2000s. The first is that a lot of these equity investments are gated by milestones, right? So NVIDIA investing $100 billion for 10 gigs at OpenAI, I mean, that is going to go gig by gig. And so we'll see how that progresses, but that's not a committed $100 billion, right? So it looks like a massive circular financing wheel, but it is gated pretty well. I would say that the second thing is, you know, these deals that we're seeing from chip makers into sort of the model producers and trainers, a lot of that is strategic, right? So if you're NVIDIA and you're sitting from a position of advantage on a GPU, you want to make sure that your roadmap and your product roadmap is aligned with OpenAI, Anthropic, Meta, Microsoft, to make sure that you are the chip that is taking, you know, the same amount of incremental share in the future, right? So I think there's the circular aspect of it that gets a lot of news, but there's also the strategic aspect, which is a viability question, I think, on the chip side. So I think those two things are actually pretty important differences.
Yeah. I feel like what we're already touching on is just the idiosyncrasies company by company, just right, in terms of how you finance, in terms of how you're going to generate revenue from these investments that they're making. So maybe if we move a little bit more to the equity side, talking about free cash flow, when you think about some of these players, they can fund a lot of this through existing free cash flow. They can tap the debt markets because they're highly rated. The cost of capital is pretty light, so they're going to use the debt markets as well. But I would imagine that understanding company by company how they're financing and how they intend to generate the revenue to justify the financing is very much a company by company evaluation. So I'd love for you to put our listeners into the research room. You all benefit from not only cross capital structure collaboration, but collaborating with your colleagues across the technology sector more broadly, other sectors and industries as well. Put us in the room. What are the things as you're evaluating equities and businesses, what are you looking for? What are the flags and the key tentpoles that you're looking for?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the biggest question that we've certainly focused on and we should continue to push on is just the return from all the CapEx, right? Because I think that goes to the question of sustainable CapEx in the future and what sustainable free cash flow and free cash flow margins looks like business by business, right? When we look out to 27 and 28. And you're right, it differs massively between companies, right? So if you take a company like Microsoft, it's a rational CapEx spender. It is building and spending its CapEx to the incremental revenue dollar that it's going to convert in cloud. It has a pretty consistent historical track record of actually monetizing cloud, right? And so when it's underwriting to commitments from its customers, it knows exactly how much it's spending and what the return is going to look like. I think that's a very different value proposition than someone like a Meta who doesn't have a cloud, right, and who is building its own open source model to distribute into, you know, a potential consumer product in the future, right? And we don't know what that looks like. So I think the models are quite different, but we spend a ton of time thinking about what the actual return needs to be to justify the CapEx. And I think the hard thing is it's coming in a number of places. Like today we're seeing the return in cloud. Today we're seeing the return in digital advertising. We're seeing Google search and Meta social advertising dollars certainly scale. But outside of that, in some pockets of coding, we're really not seeing the revenue dollars convert, right? Mm-hmm. So 2026 really for us is a year where we need to start seeing the demand inflection on the enterprise side that actually justifies the spend. We spend a ton of time with our colleagues on the ground talking to privates and talking to the people who are actually building the applications to make sure that when we're modeling to revenue at each individual company, idiosyncratically, we are not missing something on the CapEx spend. And what we see today is, while overall returns for the hyperscalers are certainly going down, returns that we see are above the cost of capital. And so if, you know, Microsoft or Google, you know, is actually getting revenue and getting returns above the cost of capital, I think this cycle is potentially too big to miss for mm-hmm. them to start underspending. And so I think that's probably the bulk of where we spend our time now thinking about is just the justified return profile. But you're right, it's different between every single company, which makes the job fun.
Yeah, yeah. I would imagine that when you're collaborating across the platform, you mentioned getting access to the private markets, and, you know, we're managing public equities and public fixed income for our clients, but how do you tap into the private markets and the research and the roadshows? Like, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, the great thing about being, you know, a large platform is that while we don't invest on the private side, we have relationships with, you know, CFOs and IRs and CEOs who used to either be part of public companies or who are in our network that we can actually tap into to say, you know, we'd love to speak to someone at OpenAI. Can we find someone on our team to actually get us in to see how they're thinking about scaling, what their cost advantage is, what the value proposition is, and how their financial goals are stacking up, and how that kind of builds to what we think about from a Microsoft or an Oracle perspective. We attend a ton of conferences. We spend a ton of time in San Francisco, just, you know, going to sell side conferences that facilitate, you know, VCs, private equity, and privates who are building actual applications and businesses in AI. We spend a ton of time talking to them about the businesses that they're trying to build and how the tooling suites are evolving. Those are probably the two biggest ways, but I would say, you know, the other great thing is podcasts like this, right, have democratized a lot of information. And so while we're getting it feels like at times we're getting, you know, news served out of a fire hose, that's also a great way that we sort of keep our pulse on the market.
Yeah. John, anything on your end there?
No, I thought that was great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like one of the things we've been talking about is uncertainty, right? I mean, this is uncharted territories. It's unprecedented levels of investment going into a capability that there's conviction in, but is yet to be truly monetized by these businesses. What gives you confidence when you see a company or when you see a revenue stream? What gives you confidence that that will sustain? What are you looking for?
I mean, for us, it's really, that's a hard question. So I think the other thing, going back to your last question on returns, I think it's also important to think about not just the revenue conversion, but the actual cost and the labor impact to a lot of these investments. And so, you know, when we look at, you know, a business like businesses like Google or Microsoft, we're looking at the top line and how the CapEx is actually translating to the viability and the profitability of the business. We're also looking at, you know, what the compute is going towards internally to actually create the tooling and the product suite, how they're getting their own internal efficiencies on engineering, how they're deploying GPU to actually scale product and go to market. And so, you know, when we think about overall return, I think the numbers sort of get somewhat muddied. And so I think there's a lot of, you know, news flow out there in the press that, you know, returns are not where they need to be. And I would just caution that the return can be on the revenue line and the OpEx line. And so when we think about, you know, sustainable levels of investment, I think we need to think about, you know, both buckets.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, even yesterday we had a large bank that we're invested in, and we were talking to them, and they gave us a pretty large number that they think that they're, you know, hoping to target on OpEx saves for next year, because they're getting savings from coding, they're getting savings from back office. We're seeing it in IT services numbers and financials as companies sort of look at ways to utilize AI to take out costs. And so when we think about sustainability, hearing those anecdotes and seeing those in numbers, I think is just as important as seeing sort of the revenue conversion hyperscale.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, so much of the industry is focused on the revenue side, and there is value to be realized on the other side as well. So that's a good perspective. So let's talk about another area of uncertainty, which is geopolitics. And we published in our 2026 outlook, one of the key themes we talked about in that as well was just really understanding and navigating geopolitics and the geopolitical risks that are out there. And I would imagine with all of this funding, given that it's not just US data centers that are being built, these are being built around the world and this funding is going around the world, that geopolitics creates some risk to a business's investment decisions and their CapEx spend. Maybe spend a minute talking about that. How do you think about that? How do we as a team sort of wrestle with that?
So I maybe have a little bit of a unique lens in that I actually cover aerospace and defense on the fixed income side as well. You know, so we spend a lot of time actually as part of that thinking about the budget and the administration's priorities as it relates to national security. And I think there's a pretty clear view among administration officials here in the U.S. as well as in other countries that AI has the potential to be a real game changer, and that leadership in that is going to be of strategic importance to us from just the national security perspective going forward. And so as you think about the constraints and the question marks around our leadership, there's kind of two big pieces to it. It's energy security and making sure that we have the energy available to power all of these data centers, the labor in order to build the data centers, and reshoring semiconductors, because we continue to remain very reliant on TSMC in Taiwan for the vast majority of these AI accelerators. So all of that is kind of going into the mix in how they think about our needs going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the last, 4 to 5 years, we've seen a number of regulations from the U.S. on China in terms of, what in the semiconductor industry is actually allowed to pass from a technology perspective, right? So selling GPUs into that market, right? And what chips we can actually sell into that market just to protect our, overall national, interest in technology leadership. What's interesting is that, the actual vast majority of chip production from NVIDIA's side is coming from Taiwan. Mm. And so, what we think about and how we think about, the multiples we want to pay for, something in semis that does have that geopolitical profile is, we spent the last 3 years restricting China. Is there a point where China comes back and restricts access for us, right? And so we've seen a lot of semiconductor build out and capacity build out in the U.S. and other parts of the world that start to globalize us a little bit. But the reality is in 3 years, I think only 30% of TSMC production is going to sit outside of Taiwan, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not nearly enough if you look at the CapEx dollars these companies are spending to give us the chip capacity that we would need. So when we think about, what to pay for businesses like this, that's certainly top of mind, right? We need to make sure that that access to capacity is actually there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is uncertain times. It's a global problem, and it's capital structure issues that we're dealing with here. So I'm curious, maybe as our last question, how do you all on the investment team support each other through this? You're navigating a lot of complexity. You've got a global team, you've got a cross capital structure team. Any examples or thoughts on how you support each other through this research process?
Yeah, tons. I think John might be sick of me after the last couple of years.
And you of me.
I just think that, the velocity, right, with which this is moving faster than I think the last probably three technology or platform shifts have moved combined. And so, and it's happening in equity and it's happening in fixed income, right? And so, and it's not just, a technology question, it's a market question. So the concentration of the names that we follow is massive and has implications across the cap structure, but also globally and across every sector. And so, what we've tried to do is make sure that, when we're building a CapEx model and we're building, a free cash flow model, that we understand, you can't just go out and buy, 100,000 H200 chips and hope that the energy is going to be there, right? So we are doing a lot more cross-sector meetings and cross-cap structure meetings on, things like energy, right? So if John and I are modeling CapEx and we're getting to, over $1 trillion in global CapEx spend on AI in 3 years, what kind of energy and what kind of power do we need to do that? And can we make that make sense in the U.S.? And that's a question that our energy team has to step in, right? So we find ourselves doing a lot more cross-sector work. Another example would be Oracle, right? So in the fall, we, they signed a $300 billion RPO deal with OpenAI. And the question there with the balance sheet that was already 3x levered is how are they going to make this work, right? If there's a lag between when they need funding to actually capacity the data centers versus seeing revenue come online, how is it going to work? And so John and I, mostly John, spent a lot of time helping me think about, what the flows need to look like, what the high yield market is actually comfortable underwriting, what the investment grade market is comfortable underwriting, and thinking about, other special creative finance vehicles that might make sense outside of my market, but might occur more on the fixed income side. And so, we looked at it, I couldn't quite get there on balance sheet, but that is a question that John had to kind of help talk me through.
Yeah, I mean, you'll remember in the fall, there was a lot that in the press around Oracle's creditworthiness and its CDS spreads were blowing out and its bond spreads were blowing out. Through working with Erica, on the fixed income side, it was immensely helpful, in her ability to help me sensitize the CapEx numbers. So last fall, when Oracle brought a large deal, to be able to compare our models and to say, wow, I think the market's still really underestimating CapEx. I think there's another deal coming. I think this feels a little a little tight, you know, from a spread perspective. And you know, I just, it feels like this could get a little bit worse. And so that collaboration really does result in good outcomes across the platform and good investment decisions, I think, that ultimately benefit the client.
Yeah, well, it's really helpful to get your perspective and for bringing some of this to life. As I like to say, it's like putting us in the room to hear the conversations and the things that you guys are wrestling with as a team. So thank you for that. And thank you for listening to All Angles. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And until next time, be sure to consider your investment decisions from all angles. The views expressed are those of the speaker and are subject to change at any time. These views are for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a recommendation to purchase any security or as an offer of securities or investment advice. No forecast can be guaranteed. Past performance is no guarantee of future results.